comparison. And it's probably better.
I can't see that very well. I mean, I can see it, but it's just so much easier to do it here.
And especially that back. They should get bigger.
No, we didn't.
Because I think
we never.
And that's the only.
Today is April 13th, 2017. This is the Joint Committee on Ways and Means Subcommittee on Human Services. Today is a continuation of the public hearings on Senate Bill 5526 and House Bill 5026. And today is kind of a joint hearing on the shared services component. And so we'll go ahead and bring up, I have Dr. Richardson, Deputy Director Erickson, Chief Financial Officer Moore, and Chief Financial Officer Mark Fairbanks. But Miss Byerly, whoa. Is there a thing you'd like to?
Speechless, Mr. Kutcher.
And I'm just saying, your counterpart, Miss Ames, found that hilarious.
Miss somebody because there's 2, 4, 5.
So what are we doing? Are we doing the HB or the SB?
It's the one presentation. So it doesn't matter which one.
When you're ready.
It's just that we have to post for both.
If you don't mind,
please.
I can hear Ms. Ames clarifying that down to the table. So in OLIS today, you will see two presentations because there are two bills that are posted, but it's the same presentation under both bills. That's just so if someone's looking at OLIS by the bill number, they can find it.
Good morning. My name is Reginald Richardson. I'm the Deputy Director for the Department of Human Services. What we're going to do today, last week we discussed the Department of Human Services central services. This week we're presenting the centralized services that represent both DHS and OHA's, what we call shared services. DHS will start, and then hand off to our colleagues at OHA for the second half of our presentation. With me at the table is, to my left, is Don Erickson, our Assistant Deputy Director at DHS. Since Don will be probably the only new face that you haven't had a chance to meet yet, I wanted to tell you a little bit about Don. Don has been the Assistant Deputy Director at DHS for less than a year. Prior to that, he served as the Chief Operating Officer for our Adults and People with Disabilities and Developmental Disabilities Division. Don came to Oregon 3 years ago from Arizona, where he was the Bureau Chief of the Adult and Children's Behavioral Health System of Care for the state of Arizona. In his current role at DHS, he is in charge of our shared services. To my right, my colleague Mark Fairbanks is the Chief Financial Officer for the Oregon Health Authority, and to his right is Kristen Deuce, our Chief Information Officer for the Office of Information Services in the Oregon Health Authority. Eric Moore, which you've seen a lot during these last 4 weeks, will join us in a few minutes for his part of the presentation. If we advance the slides, what you'll see is our agenda and what we hope to accomplish in a little bit of time that we have today. Folks who work in shared services often joke that they know that they're really doing their job well when the work that they do is actually invisible. While they might not come to mind often for the clients who get services from either agency, they are absolutely essential for our ability to deliver services to Oregonians. Shared services, along with central services we talked about last week, share a significant amount of responsibility for the delivery of services to Oregonians. They do many of the things that keep large organizations like the Department of Human Services and Oregon Health Authority running. They take care of our facilities. They keep people safe. They keep our networks and computers running. They make sure that providers and vendors get paid, and much more. Programs depend on them pretty heavily, and working together, we make it possible for DHS and OHA to help Oregonians achieve healthy health, safety, and independence. Because there are several new members to this committee, that might not have heard about shared services before, we wanted to take a few moments to provide some explanations of how the origin and how shared services function. One thing you will notice as we move through our presentation is that the programs that became shared services were not evenly split among DHS or OHA. All shared services are housed within DHS except the Office of Information Services, which is housed in OHA. Although the number of shared services each agency houses is different, the operating budget and staffing levels are similar. Don Erickson is the Assistant Deputy Director, as I mentioned, and is in charge of shared services at DHS, and I'm going to ask him to walk you through the governance and the maintenance of shared services.
Okay. Good morning, and thank you for the time this morning. Co-Chair Steiner Hayward and Co-Chair Rayfield in committee. What we have on the diagram is a very simplified, but it's actually a pretty simple process that shows what the governance is for shared services. OHA and DHS have a specific shared services memorandum of understanding that really outlines both who is going to manage which of the shared services. It describes sort of the process for decision making, and as you'll see on the diagram, we have two committees that are required as part of the shared services, the Joint Budget Committee and the Joint Allocation Committee. Those committees and really all of us in shared services report directly to either Dr. Richardson on the DHS side or Mark Fairbanks on the OHA side. In turn, we have a joint leadership committee that meets monthly, and if there are issues, concerns, news, reporting that's required from shared services, it's reported out at that committee meeting. If the MOU specifies that if, for whatever reason, there's some issue that can't be resolved either at Dr. Richardson and Mark Fairbanks level, that that would ultimately get elevated to our directors, Clyde Psyche and Lynn. Fortunately, that I don't think happens very often. So, but that's the way it's designed in the MOU. The MOU also specifies that the services themselves will each one of the programs will have a service level agreement that really serves as a vendor, a customer contract that includes an outline of the services that the particular program is going to provide to each agency, how the program is going to be funded, some information on staffing of the program, and then it also outlines how we're going to measure whether or not services are provided as agreed upon, and it also gives a formula for the cost allocation between the two programs. On a regular basis, at least once a month, generally once a month, the two programs get together at the Joint Allocation Committee and review again the how those services have been divided and whether or not we're in accordance with the service level agreement. Okay, and with that, I'll pass it back to Dr. Richardson.
Thanks, Don. What you're looking at is our depiction of DHS in your communities. You've spent the last several weeks hearing about our programs, and we wanted to create an image that shows you how the programs and operations side of our work fit together to provide services that guide Oregonians to safety, health, and independence. It's these footings or foundations of our agencies that everything else we do is built upon. The next slide shares our DHS Shared Services mission and our operating principles. Our mission describes the core function and our purpose, while our operating principles are our fundamental norms that we agree that guide our work, our behavior, decisions, and actions. Don will talk about some of the examples or highlights of our work.
This slide just gives you a graphic depiction of the volume of work that are done by many of the shared services. Again, it's where we're serving between the two agencies over 9,000 staff, both here in Salem and out in the field. And again, it requires a lot of work through publication, facilities management, and certainly through the IT programs. The one that I want to make a note about is facilities. We have in this graphic that the facilities handles or manages approximately 3 million square feet of property throughout Oregon. That translates to 180 some facilities that 29 people in facilities keep running and keep the leases current and try to keep the offices comfortable and safe. In the middle of the winter, they get called out to Ontario when the roof is sagging because of snow accumulation, and they work very, very hard. And again, it's just a good example of the again the volume of work, and I think the quality of work that those folks do. Looking at each one of the operating principles that Dr. Richardson noted, I'm going to provide some examples of how we take those operating principles and use them as a filter for our decision making in the programs. It's expected that our program managers will, in the course of planning and decision making, that they will consider these operating principles in their decision making process. So as examples, we've been able to, over the last, an example of customer-centered operating principles that, first of all, we need to know in order to be able to fulfill this commitment, we need to really know what the needs of our customers are. We need to be able to get out in the field and really understand what their work entails. We need to solicit feedback from the customers so that drives continued improvement, incremental improvement of the way that we provide our services. We default to the need of the customer rather than our own convenience in terms of how we provide that service. And we're committed to delivering a high quality of service as defined by best practices and by the feedback that we get from our customers.
Can I ask a question that may sound rude about that one, but it's not rude to you guys? How far out of your way do you go to accommodate the customer outside of your regular business practices? Which is to say, I'm a firm believer in prioritizing the needs of customers. Mm-hmm. On the other hand, one could imagine that there's a lot of one-off situations, and if you go keep mucking up your business practices every single time somebody has a particular need, that's not very good for anybody.
Absolutely.
Ultimately. So could you talk a little bit about how you balance those two priorities?
Senator Steiner-Hayward, the balance is the key word there, and it really is a balancing act. Without question, we try to approach issues to, again, make people's work smoother and better and more effective. But there are times when, you know, we do have to say, you know, no. I mean, that at least not now. One of the examples, again, is when we look at our facilities operations, is that we have, as I mentioned before, a relatively small number of people managing a lot of square footage throughout the state. And it makes it challenging if somebody wants to, and this may seem like a trite example, but I think it speaks to your issue, that I see that there's a nice cubicle open over by the window, and nobody's in it, and so I put in a request to move to that cube. Just that part actually involves quite a lot, and it involves, you know, bringing in at times a contractor to actually make adjustments to the desk and make it ergonomically correct and so forth. But what it also does is it kind of, then we have to realign our sort of math of that area, because we may have had plans to move somebody into that spot as part of a larger move. And so that's an example where at times we have to find that balance between accommodating the customer and also saying, this just, at the present time, this isn't a reasonable request. Does that make sense?
Yep, thank you.
Please, Senator Winters.
I need to follow up because you're using the word customer. Are you talking about staff as the customer? Are you talking about providers as the customer? Who's your customer?
Thank you, Senator Winters. It's a great question. I apologize for not addressing it earlier. The customer is twofold. It's we look at customer as staff providing services to Oregonians, and so both are customers. But in the sense that our assumption is that the better we're able to accommodate staff and the better we're able to keep them operating, the better they're going to be able to provide their services to the Oregonians that we serve. Does that speak to that? But in most cases, the requests that we get through shared services are from other staff. But what we're conscious of is how does that translate into service delivery to our to Oregonians?
I guess to simplify it, we're basically talking about staff.
For the most part.
Okay. I mean, that makes a lot more sense than this big universe out there, because you also in facilities, and I'm sitting here thinking, well, DAS does a lot of the will help if you're talking about building a facility or moving to a different facility. So I'm just, my mind is trying to figure out what you're actually addressing.
I'm going to jump ahead just a little bit to also give you an example using facilities as an example that with our facilities, we certainly work with the staff and the community stakeholders to try to find a location and a type of facility that that works for staff well, that is that has good public transportation access and so forth. But we're also, when we're looking at a facility design or redesign or remodel, we're looking at things like, especially over the last year, we're looking at, does the facility, is the facility that we're putting together work from the standpoint of trauma-informed care? I mean, that there are standards that in the around the country for being able to be conscious of individuals coming to our facilities who have experienced trauma, and we try to accommodate that as best we can. So we that means clear signage. It means, oh, excuse me.
I want to get to the future. Are your plans developed ahead enough to talk about co-locations and where you're going to actually in the future site facilities so that they're more convenient to the population that we serve? I'm not talking staff now. I'm talking about the population that that you serve, so that the work with DAS, when you know you when leases are up, and you need to recite or whatever, that's a part of your long range planning.
Senator Winters, absolutely. We're in the process right now of developing a 10-year plan, and as we approach it, looking at a 10-year plan, we're thinking that probably needs to be a 15-year plan to be able to look ahead and try to anticipate, again, what the needs of the community are going to be down the road. Try to make it as convenient as by providing as much of a one-stop shop as possible. So, yes, it's very much on our minds.
Can I suggest that be one of, follow-up, Mr. Chair, that be one of your overarching goals, that we really do move towards making certain that facilities that are being developed, you know, once leases are up, that actually serve the needs of the population, taking into consideration the whole, and working with ODOT and others as to transportation and some of those other issues, because the population that you serve sometimes do not have, you know, automobiles or other ways to get to the facilities?
Co-chairs and Senator Winters, absolutely. That's is a priority, and we'll continue to make it a priority. Some other examples where we're of the customer-centered, and I'll run through these fairly quickly, but we've looked at our contracting processes, and we've tried to do an analysis to see what steps of contracting really are critical, and particularly of small contracts, and we've been able to streamline the contracting process, particularly for contracts under $150,000, and reduce the number of steps and reduce the number of pages of the contract from 60-some to a little over a dozen, which really has helped to accommodate smaller businesses getting involved in our contracting process. It's less daunting and less overwhelming, and it's far more efficient time-wise, while still, you know, including the elements of a contract that we need to ensure we get what we're contracting for.
Your Senator Hayward.
Just a quick point. Thank you. Mm-hmm. This is exactly what we expect folks like you and others who are in agency positions to be doing. Those concrete tracks are historically full of a lot of boilerplate. It's impossible for even experienced businesses to understand without the services of an attorney. And it's an unnecessary expense on both sides, and it's inefficient, and it's wasteful. And so when you do things like that to pare down the contract so that they're actually understandable by a reasonable person, then that's the kind of government function that we should be offering to Oregonians. So thank you.
You're very welcome. Senator Steiner Hayward, I appreciate that and agree completely. Along those lines, the next slide talks to our efforts of trying to, again, be conscious of continuing that improvement process, constantly doing an analysis of the way that we're conducting business and looking for ways to streamline that and to make things more understandable and more accessible to folks. You'll appreciate the last bullet on that. With our general contracting, again, we've been able to reduce number of steps to go through contracting from 50 to down to 22. I mean, if we actually break it down into the process of actually developing a contract. So, again, it speaks to the issue you were just addressing.
Please, Senator Winters.
Thank you. I'd like to go back and to the, and you didn't mention, but it is on this page, about the increased in recovery. Oh, you're still on sentry. Never mind, I'll wait.
Is it this one?
Yes, the $1.2 million.
Yeah.
Two questions. Thank you, Mr. Chair. And that is this a biennial figure, number one, or is it an annual figure? And
this is. I did specify which it was. This was an annual, because the estimate, we did an estimate for the biennium, and this was the amount that we were able to, the improvement that we were able to see in the first year. So that is an annual figure.
That's the annual figure of overpayments that's been recovered?
Exactly.
And how much were the expenditures that it took in order to get this particular dollar amount?
That I would have to do some research, and I'd be more than happy, Senator Winters, to back to you.
And can you break out for us the various components that you actually recovered, mm-hmm. rather than the global figure?
Absolutely.
Thank you.
Okay. The next operating principle I'll just mention, and again, you can see some of the examples of that are developing sustainable, strong business partnerships. And with that, we're talking about partnerships both between our agencies, with other state agencies, but other parts of the community as well, placing a stronger emphasis on creating those partnerships and keeping them healthy and active. The next slide talks about being intentionally inclusive, and again, this is the intentional piece is to emphasize of being very conscious in our decision making of whether we are reaching out to the right people in the community, and trying to be sure that we have the right people at the table, and that we're connecting with the right folks out in the community who either need our services or need to participate with our services. And with that, I'll move it on to back to Dr. Richardson.
I think we switch seats now.
I think I'm going to switch with Eric. Okay.
The The next slide describes a little bit of the safety improvements within DHS. Safety has been a top priority across DHS every day. We have a core belief that every child and adult deserves to live safely, free from abuse and neglect. Our shared services contributes to the safety of Oregonians we serve, and I want to share some of the work that we've been doing across programs and agencies to improve the safety of children and others in our care. In addition to direct daily safety services, DHS also is the statewide lead for the provision of food, water, and shelter during a declared mass emergency situation, and we've had significant progress as we try to bring that up to fruition. You will see by the slide under safety improvements, figure one represents the change that we've seen in our Office of Adult Abuse and Prevention and Investigations. Prior to our implementation of 1515, you saw that the number of investigations were roughly about 50 per month. And then after the implementation of 1515, you saw an increase of investigations and our ability to close those investigations and determine whether or not children were safe in child caring agencies. In addition, over the past year or so, we've conducted three internal safety audits with a focus of supporting child caring agencies. The audits focused on child welfare, our AWAPI, and our licensing and regulatory oversight programs. Through those audits, we identified 54 communication and process gaps, including clarifying roles and responsibilities of each of those units when it comes to an investigation, and we're working our way down the list now, closing those gaps. And I'll stop there and turn it over to Eric.
Good morning. For the record, my name is Eric Warren, the Chief Financial Officer for the Department of Human Services. In the interest of saving of efficiency, you've seen this slide before in our central service presentation, but it has applicability to shared services as well. Our primary challenges are similar to central in that for the challenges for shared services are increasing demand with limited resources, staffing and resourcing not keeping pace with the need, demand being driven by caseloads that trickle down to shared services processes, and that we don't have enough operations resources to support organizations of our size. When you take away operations support, it negatively impacts performance in the field where our direct work with Oregonians happens. In the governor's budget, there are a couple of investments in the shared services arena. One of them is the background check unit. The background check unit, which is part of the shared services human resources office, is a good example of increasing demand with limited resources. First, I'd like to note that up in the budget numbers, it does not include the other funds of the background check unit, which are double-counted other funds that I'll explain in a few slides, of about $7.3 million. In 2016, the background check unit did over 147,000 background checks or fitness determinations. Overall, the number of background checks has been reduced to the 2014 levels due to the long-term care registry that covers approximately 111,000 long-term care workers, including home care and personal support workers. Since the registry started, almost 34,000 background checks have been avoided due to the registry. However, while this has created efficiencies for the program overall, complexity has increased significantly. For example, Adult Protective Services and Child Protective Services checks have become more complex, especially with out-of-state activities that we must equate to Oregon statutes when determining fitness. The current backlog is about 6 weeks. This means providers have to wait to be certified to be able to perform their work. We have put some limited duration resources to try and reduce that backlog, but with further increases anticipated, it is likely the backlog will continue to increase under current laws and expectations of DHS doing increasing numbers of background checks and, more importantly, more complex background checks.
Please, Senator Winters.
Can you expand a little bit on, quote, the complexity of the background check?
Sure. Our estimates for increased complexity is based on anticipated increases due to the changes in federal and state law related to fingerprinting all, quote, high-risk individuals, and that's under ORS 455-434. We've had changes.
Is OSP doing your background checks?
They do the fingerprints and do the initial checks, and we do the fitness determinations.
Can you share with this panel what activities go into the fitness determination?
I'm not that knowledgeable as to the process of fitness determination, so I'd have to get back to you on that.
Just get a report.
Yeah, we can respond in writing. It'd be fine.
Yeah. Representative Maelstrom.
I heard what you said regarding, you know, the fingerprinting and the regulations and all this is increasing. But when I look at this chart, there is literally double between 2016 and 2017. That's more than the 64% increase. Can you explain why? I mean, in the projection, it keeps going up kind of on a, you know, a steady sort of incline. But there's this huge jump there.
So, co-chairs and Representative Maelstrom, the chart on this slide is not a representation of the number of background checks. It is an estimate of the increase in complexity of background checks, where we have had additional requirements to do, for example, adding fingerprints to doing it, adding CPS checks, and other activities that have made background checks more complex than they originally were. And so this is an attempt through timings to show how increases in the types of checks is going to change over time.
Okay, follow up?
Please.
So is it fair to say that the complexity has doubled in this one-year period?
I'm not sure I can answer whether it's doubled or not.
Well, that's kind of what the
number
would say.
Yeah, I would say that the complexity has definitely increased significantly.
Okay. Representative Alonso Leon.
Thank you, Chair. I just have a quick question around, I understand that the workload is increasing because of the more complex the requirements. Just give me a ballpark what that equates to in respect to FTE, how many more people we need to make sure that we're not backlogged, but that we can be at a pace where we're on time.
Our estimate, co-chairs, Representative Alonso Leon, the estimate that we have and the request that's in the governor's budget is for 22 positions.
22 additional positions.
Additional positions. It's budgeted at 11 FTE, so for half the biennium, assuming that it'll take us some time for us to get up and running with those folks.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Please, Senator.
It would be helpful for me, Eric, if you would break out the complexity and whether or not that complexity is driven by federal requirements or state requirements, so that we can begin zeroing in on what really is happening beyond the background check or the fingerprinting that takes place. That we know, but you're adding some dimension that I think would be helpful for this body to have a better understanding of what that is.
And Co-Chair Senator Winter, we can bring that back.
Thank you.
Back to you. The next slide is also a slide that you saw last week. It's about our integrated eligibility project. The reason that we're doing the integrated eligibility project with the Medicaid eligibility system are that individuals need to be able to access their benefits in the right way at the right time. DHS programs exist on old mainframe systems that aren't flexible enough to keep up with the needs of Oregonians and the growing expectations of state and federal partners. DHS staff have to do eligibility manually, risking error and potentially delaying benefits. Oregonians deserve more efficient and effective government, and this will create a platform to move us in that direction. The next slide is the slide that you've seen many times before. What I neglected to do, the shared services is 1% of the total funds budget for DHS. It is a part of the light blue slice that is pulled out on this slide. The next slide shows the a breakdown of the DHS offices within shared services. I'd just like to highlight a couple of the major ones. The Office of Payment Accuracy and Recovery, which does estate and other collections and quality assurance work. The Office of Financial Services, which, amongst many other things, process billions in payments every year. And the Shared Office of Human Resources that does classifications, records, and background checks, as we just discussed, for the approximately 12,000 DHS and OHA positions. Hopefully the next slide is looks more complex than it actually is. On the left-hand side are the other fund expenditures of each agency's shared services. The total anticipated expenditures, as you can see, is $295.4 million. On the right side, it shows the revenues that support the combined $295.4 million in shared services expenditures. This is how we pay for our shared services. And we mentioned this, at least for in DHS, it's the shared services funding bucket is in our SAEC budget. I believe it's in the central services budget for OHA. And those are the buckets that are the primary funders of our shared services. In this case, DHS and OHA shared services funding pays for 96% of shared services expenditures, where 4% is paid directly by project or program budgets. Altogether, and the point of this slide is to show that the $295.4 million of anticipated costs are covered by $295.4 million in estimated revenues. And if there are no additional questions, I'll turn it over to my colleague, Mark Fairbanks.
Good morning. Co-chairs in the committee, my name is Mark Fairbanks. I'm the Chief Financial Officer for the Oregon Health Authority, and I have with me Kristen Dews, who is the Director of our Office of Information Systems. I want to describe to you very briefly the scope of services for this body of work, which is quite a large endeavor across these two agencies. With you've seen slides previously that talk about the number of locations, the number of employees, and if you recall the slide, it was slide the examples of our work. It doesn't have a number on it here. But that particular slide, which talks about, you know, a lot of what DHS is doing, all of those blue boxes are supported by the infrastructure for IT that is managed by Kristen and her team, in addition to the services that are provided through the Oregon Health Authority. So we are supporting the technology needs for the two agencies with 12,000 plus agency staff plus partners. We have 250-plus applications related to a variety of eligibility, enrollment, benefit insurance, licensing, protective services, public health, case management, hospital management, provider payments, and others. There are over 300 technology tools and support applications that are being supported by OIS, and there are over 23,000 technology devices that are actually procured, managed, and retired by the unit. I'd also like to point out that OIS is providing information security and privacy program management, education and awareness, risk and vulnerability management, and e-discovery, which is a public records platform for the two agencies. Next slide simply places, for your knowledge or information, the OIS within my responsibility for OHA and with shared services. And I'd like to also harken back to the slide on our governance system between DHS and OHA, which assists Kristen and her team in all of their work to make sure that we are giving them the right level of prioritization. In the world of taking care of an information system platform, there are hundreds of things that go on every day, and all of them need attention. But when it comes to projects and fixes, they require prioritization to what is going to matter the very most. It's a first things first argument. If we try to do everything for everybody, we won't do everything very well. So that's another thing that you'll hear Kristen talk about. And with that, I will bring Kristen up, and we'll talk about accomplishments and some other information about the details. Excuse us.
Well orchestrated.
Good morning. Co-Chair Steiner Hayward, Co-Chair Rayfield, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Kristen Deuce. I'm the Chief Information Officer serving both the Department of Human Services and the Oregon Health Authority. I joined the Office of Information Services about 2.5 years ago with the opportunity to help my organization get back on its feet again. I think it's no secret that my organization has a bit of a storied past, but when I came in, I found a dedicated group of professionals that was really ready to learn from the past and to put Cover Oregon behind us. And so we got busy putting together our new story. As with many IT organizations, we're often known best for the major visible projects that we do, and I think that Dr. Richardson talked about in a shared services organization, we're also often known only when there's a problem. So the majority of our work, though, is really what we call KTLO, that's keeping the lights on, and that's really about how we make sure that we keep those applications that Mr. Fairbanks talked about, the 250 applications, the 20,000 devices, and the day-to-day technology needs working and secure and stable for our 20,000 customers. And in this case, I'm talking about customers as staff, because primarily those are our customers in the Office of Information Services. We knew that it wasn't going to be enough for us to just tell the agencies and to tell you that we were doing things differently and that we were going to be able to be successful. We knew we would have to prove it, and so we decided we needed to let the numbers tell our story. So one of the first things that we did is we implemented a performance management system, and this is the same system or framework that I believe that you've seen from other agencies and other large organizations that really sets and defines the core processes for an organization and then sets measurements so that we know that we're doing that work well. This framework has helped us to articulate the foundational work that we do. And we have set targets against 25 measures, and we meet quarterly to celebrate our successes and to identify the areas where we need to lean in. I've listed a few on the slide here that I thought that I would point out as a result of this work. One of those is that we have decreased the average ticket resolution at our service desk, and we've been able to increase the number of tickets that we're able to resolve on first contact with our customer. And again, primarily our customers are the staff of the two agencies. We're also working to implement a standard IT governance structure. Mr. Fairbanks alluded to that. And that's really so that we ensure that we're working on the right work at the right time. We take security and privacy seriously in our agencies, and it starts with education and awareness. In 2015, we implemented a new version of our mandatory annual security and privacy training. And I'm proud to say that in 2016, 97% of the 12,000 DHS and OHA staff completed this training. So now on to the next slide. We also knew that we needed to make changes in how we do IT projects. We would need to prove to our business partners and the agencies, to the Office of the State CIO, to the Legislative Fiscal Office, to our federal partners, to you and to ourselves, that we could deliver business value through successful IT projects. So we turned to industry best practices. We created a project management office. We often call it a PMO. We adopted an industry standard project management methodology, and we have standards for reporting status and progress. In the 2015 to 2017 biennium, we successfully completed 14 major IT projects. And for us, that's 14 projects that were over $1 million. So I've highlighted on this slide three of the projects, three of those 14 projects. The first one here, most of you are probably aware of, this stemmed from legislation in the 2015 legislature, and then later in 2016, added mandated functionality for the intake, storage, tracking, auditing, and reporting of medical marijuana data for growers and distributors. We had very tight timelines to complete this work, and I'm proud of our team that completed this work within the timelines and on budget. The next project that we've listed up here is another project for which we're particularly proud. In the spring of 2016, in partnership with the Supplemental Nutrition Program for Women, Infants, and Children, that's the WIC program, we completed the statewide rollout of electronic benefit transfer system to replace the use of paper vouchers for the distribution of WIC food benefits. This project eliminated many manual processes, and it provided the WIC program much more access to data so they could track how food dollars were used. At the WIC clinics, staff can now spend more time on nutrition education. And at the grocery stores, we all benefit by faster lines. We also completed the work at the Oregon State Hospital for implementation of an electronic health record system. This has been a multi-year rollout of new functionality and modules over time. And we completed the last of this work this spring with implementation of a medication management system and disaster recovery functionality. This next slide here shows our two largest systems that we support. You've probably heard of them both. The first is the Medicaid Management Information System. This is the application that we use to pay healthcare providers for Medicaid services to our clients. This last year, the MMIS processed $4.9 billion in capitation payments to CCOs and $2.7 billion in other payments. We completed six major projects this biennium tied to the Medicaid Management Information Systems. This included new functionality required by our partners, our federal partners, the Center for Medicaid and Medicare Services. And we also completed a major upgrade to the operating system and the infrastructure that MMIS sits on. The one system, the next one listed here, is our new eligibility system for the MAGI population. That's the Modified Adjusted Gross Income population. We implemented a worker portal in December of 2015, replacing what remained of the last of the Cover Oregon systems. This application was delivered on time. And then we also implemented in 2016, under two different implementations, the worker portal was implemented first, applicant portal then was implemented in 2016. And the thing to know about this application is we delivered it in a very short time frame with very base functionality. So we delivered a base system knowing that we would have to spend additional time adding additional functionality. And we've been doing that here in 2016, adding worker efficiencies and dealing with some workarounds that were implemented at the time of implementation. And this is the base system for the integrated eligibility, Medicaid eligibility project that Mr. Moore referred to, that will add eligibility determination for additional programs, the non-MAGI population, TANF, SNAP, and the employment-related daycare programs. Okay, with that, I'll turn it back over to Mr. Fairbanks.
Just stay there. That's good. I can hang on the end of the table if the committee doesn't mind. So the next slide, we just take out a slice, if you recall, back on slide 20, when Eric was talking about the combined budget for our limitation. This just peels out the OIS portion. And also, if you'll notice the orange box, it also indicates our Information Security and Privacy Office, which resides in OIS and its budget. For the next biennium, we have highlighted four policy option packages. The first, POP 102, is to provide the funding for the current centralized abuse management program, and that's to implement a centralized system for tracking, reporting, and supporting investigations of adult abuse. The funding for the initiation and planning phases of this project were received in the current biennium, and we have just recently added a vendor to assist. The second, POP 201, funds the IEME project, as Dr. Richardson mentioned earlier, and the repricing is underway for that effort. POP 406, the third one listed on the slide, is for a continued enhancement of the one. That is the MAGI system that Kristen just alluded to, and it is to move forward with additional features and functions and to automate current what are called process workarounds or manual workarounds, which are now being automated. And this is the base system to get the integrated eligibility system for Oregon up and going in its 360-degree vision. The last pop in this slide is to start the planning efforts for to replace our current 8-year-old MMIS system. This is going to take multi-bienniums to get accomplished. The first phase will be to identify options for moving to a modular approach. So instead of having a big bang approach and the architecture being one big unit.
Senator Winters.
Yes, I'm sorry. Senator Winters.
Thank you. And, you know, MMIS has kind of been on the radar screen and inaction and overaction and underaction for so many years. When will we ever actually get it to where it's functional that we won't be talking about MMIS in this building?
I'll take that.
Co-Chair Hayward, Steiner Hayward, Co-Chair Rayfield, Senator Winters. We brought a work group together last year as a result of a budget note that came to us to really take a look at the concerns that had come forward from the MMIS, Medicaid Management Information System. And out of that work group, we identified 25 items that folks had brought forward. And this was a work group that was made up of members from the coordinated care organizations, the CCOs, as well as providers and internal staff. And what we came up with were two of those 25 were system related. The rest of the complaints that we were hearing were primarily data issues that were left over from the work that we had done under Cover Oregon. So the Cover Oregon system, the data had a lot of data issues that were being passed through to the MMIS. And then other situations, they were actually policy or security concerns that they had brought forward. An example of that would be a request came forward for us to reduce the amount of time until a screen would time out, meaning that if a worker had a screen up of the application, and then after a certain amount of time, because of security reasons, they get logged off. And they asked that we reduce or we increase the time that that screen was up before that timeout. There's actually rules and laws coming from CMS that set a limit for what that timeout could be. And so there were some things like that that we were not able to accommodate. But the two system changes that were brought forward, we have fixed. And so, and then here in January, Mark and I also met with the CCOs again to follow up and ask for concerns or issues that were pertaining to MMIS. And we did not have any specific MMIS issues.
Follow up. Do you have any idea or anything that could tell us how much we've actually invested in the MMIS system?
Co-chairs, committee, Senator Winters, I would have to go back and get that number for you. I do not have the accumulation of investment in MMIS.
Thank you. I know it's substantial because it's an issue that's in every
probably
session.
Be a lot. I would like to add to my colleague Kristen's comment on MMIS. I think perhaps I'll take a stab at the answer to your question this way, that the modularization or the design of the actual architecture of the system is a problem in and of itself. And so to be able to compartmentalize, if you will, or segment the system design, not being a technologist, you'll have to keep me out of going down the wrong road here, but as I understand it, you know, as changes happen, and they happen a lot, that system is constantly evolving. It constantly has to evolve because the rules change. And so instead of having to go in, and it's a little bit like the old green screen versus a laptop or versus the new programming languages. We need something that we can go in and fix, if you will, or change and add feature function to in its section so that we don't have to rewrite the whole darn thing. That's a simple way to look at it. She's looking at me funny. She might want to help me out.
So, Senator Winters, I think the majority of the changes we make now are really requirements that are coming down from CMS and as a result of policy changes, as a result of the Affordable Care Act, many different policy changes that are coming to us.
I guess another way to follow up of asking that question is how much are the feds helping to offset some of the costs with all the changes that they request or they require?
Co-Chair, Senator Winters, the majority of the changes that we're able to make to the MMIS are funded at 90% federal funds, 10% general funds.
Thank you. All right. Close it out.
Thank you. Shared services provide a critically important and necessary infrastructure. as we attempt to support our programs and our customers both internally and externally. However, the need to support these programs continue to increase while resources are not keeping pace. The summary page, I think, makes that point as a few others. And I just want to say on behalf of DHS and OHA, we thank the committee for your time and listening to us for the last several weeks. And we appreciate the opportunity to have presented shared services today. So thank you. All right. We'd be happy to take any questions you might have.
Yeah. Are there any other questions? Seeing none, Ms. Byron?
Mr. Kocher, members of the subcommittee, there's no meeting on Monday, but there are meetings with topics, I think, from OHA next Tuesday and Wednesday. Is that correct, Linda? So we're done. We have completed the whole, we have completed the agency budget overviews. We're moving on to phase two activities.
All right. And with that, seeing no other questions, we'll go ahead and adjourn the meeting.
Yep. Thank you.